This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Everyone takes the ferry in Istanbul. It's how the city gets from one side to the other. But stay on board a little longer and you arrive at the Prince's Islands, a cluster of nine islands southeast of Istanbul in the Sea of Marmara. Once places of exile for royals, today they're something else entirely. And on the island of Büyükada, local businesswoman Mina Akdar and her family have been enjoying the unique pace of life here for generations.
Büyükada is a place where time stands still. And as soon as you step onto the island, you feel at peace and you feel relaxed. Walking around, exploring different beaches, I think it's just wonderful for anyone who's interested in beautiful places.
Just an hour from the hustle and bustle of the city, yet a world away, the Prince's Islands are a place where doing less somehow feels like more. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Picture a windowless bunker crammed with reference books, charts, maps, screens and widgets, where you and I are joined by the world's leading experts who, in the next half hour, can tell us what it is necessary to understand about a burning issue of the day. Today, they'll brief us about President Trump, Ukraine and impeachment. What's it all about and where might it end up? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy this week's profile podcast on President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. You need to know it, we do it. Then we put it all on BBC Sounds. This week, President Trump hosted the President of Finland. At the subsequent press conference, US journalists were keen to ask about the case which has led to an impeachment inquiry by the Speaker of the US House of Representatives. A line of questioning which led to this.
Go ahead, ask a question.
The question, sir, was what did you want President Zelensky to do about Vice President Biden and his son Hunter?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, it was just a follow-up of what I just asked you, sir.
Listen, you ready? We have the president of Finland. Ask him a question.
I have one for him. I just wanted to follow up on the one that I asked you, which
did
was,
you hear
what
me?
Did you want
did you hear
to...
me?
Yes,
ask
sir.
Him a question.
I will. But
I've given you a long answer. Ask this gentleman a question. Don't be rude.
No, sir. I don't want to be rude. I just wanted you to have a chance to answer the question that I asked
I've
you.
I've answered everything. It's a whole hoax. And you know who's playing into the hoax? People like you and the fake news media that we have in this country. And I say in many cases, the corrupt media, because you're corrupt. Much of the media in this country is not just fake, it's corrupt.
I hope I'm not breaking any BBC presenters' guidelines when I say that this is not normal. So in today's briefing room, I want to understand what might be called the affair of the Ukrainian phone call and why it has so rattled the president. Step inside and we'll find out together. First, I want a straightforward briefing on what is known to have happened in the lead-up to the inquiry being launched. I was joined earlier in the briefing room by Josh Gerstein, legal affairs contributor at the website Politico, and the BBC's Jonah Fisher, who is in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Josh Gerstein, Nancy Pelosi has launched an impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump. What's it all about?
At the moment, at the core of this impeachment inquiry is a complaint that a watchdog in the intelligence community known as the Inspector General received from a CIA officer. And that complaint essentially accused the president of the United States of attempting to use his office to target one of his key political rivals, the former Vice President Joe Biden, who is considered a leading contender for the Democratic presidential nomination in the U.S. Next year. And the claim essentially is that President Trump used his power, used the funds of the United States, the military resources of the United States, to pressure the government of Ukraine to come up with dirt, for lack of a better term, on Joe Biden and on Joe Biden's son, in the hope that it would bolster President Trump's chances of re-election and harm Biden's chance of being elected.
And what form did that pressure take? In what form was it expressed?
So there was a call, and this whistleblower complaint relates to a call that took place between the president of the United States and the new president of Ukraine in July, on the 25th of July. You know, the pressure probably took several different forms, but the key event seems to have been a phone call where the two men went back and forth, and the Ukrainians were looking for various favors from the United States. We're looking for a release on more than $200 million worth of aid from the United States that had been mysteriously held up. We're also looking for additional military assistance from the United States in the form of missiles and so forth that would help them keep the Russians at bay and perhaps strengthen their hand a little bit in the Crimea dispute. And in the midst of this conversation, according to a transcript that was released recently, President Trump says that he would like a favor, though, which people are interpreting to mean, you know, in exchange for some of the things the Ukrainians were asking for. And the president goes on to say that he wants prosecutors in Ukraine to meet with a couple top lawyers in the United States, Rudy Giuliani, who's the president's top personal lawyer or one of them, and Bill Barr, who is the attorney general of the United States. I guess you could regard him as a lawyer for the president, but he is supposed to be an official lawyer for the United States government. So President Trump in this call asked the president of Ukraine to arrange for some kind of a meeting with those two men so that they could, you know, develop more information about Biden. The underlying allegation here is that Biden's son had a job where he worked for a company in Ukraine called Burisma Holdings, which was an energy company run by an oligarch there. Hunter Biden wound up on this board, doesn't seem to have a lot of skills or expertise for that particular job, but he did end up on that board for a couple of years. And that's the thing that Trump and Giuliani and apparently Barr wanted investigated.
How did the transcript of the telephone call emerge?
So there was a lot of pressure from Congress to see that come out. There are details about it in this whistleblower complaint. The whistleblower had access to the transcript and saw it. But one of the interesting things here is the way in which the transcript was stored. Traditionally, with past presidents, while these transcripts of calls between foreign leaders and presidents of the United States are considered somewhat sensitive documents, you can't get them, your hands on them very easily. Within the government, people with security clearances could actually get them pretty easily. At some point a couple years ago, after there were leaks of calls involving President Trump and the Prime Minister of Australia and the President of Mexico, I believe, the Trump White House began putting certain calls into a much, much more classified system that's really used for the nation's most sensitive intelligence secrets. And it's an odd place for this kind of a call to reside, especially since the White House eventually decided to basically make it public in its entirety. An explanation of why it was held at this code word level is one of the issues that Congress is looking into at this point.
Now, is the transcript that has been seen so far a full transcript of everything that was said?
I think it's fair to assume that this transcript is a pretty accurate and complete account of what took place in the conversation, although a lot of President Trump's critics are suspicious that there might have been other assurances. And I think as a matter of sort of diplomatic nicety, they don't typically record these calls. And so it's not a literal verbatim transcript, but the White House really hasn't disputed its authenticity.
Jonah Fisher, how does Ukraine come to be involved in a story about the possible impeachment of an American president?
Well, this all dates back to 2015, 2016, when the Biden family, Joe Biden, who was then the vice president of the United States, he was effectively the Obama administration's point man on Ukraine. So he came here quite a lot. He was very involved in what was a very difficult time for Ukraine. At the same time as that, his son, Hunter Biden, had a very well-paid job here on the board of a Ukrainian energy company, one of the biggest energy companies here in Ukraine. It's called Burisma. Now, at the time, people looked at that and said, that doesn't look quite right. Perhaps a conflict of interest between those two roles. But the Bidens shook it off and they moved on. Why has it come back? Well, because principally, Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, has really been looking into an incident at the very end of 2015, the beginning of 2016, when a prosecutor general here, a man called Viktor Shokin, was fired. And at the time, Joe Biden was very active in pushing that prosecutor general out.
Now, why was he pushing the prosecutor general out, as far as we now know?
That is the key question. According to President Trump's supporters, according to what Rudy Giuliani says when he goes on American network TV, it was linked to Hunter Biden, basically Joe Biden's son, and that it was because the Ukrainian energy company was being investigated. So Biden Sr., the vice president, stepped in and demanded that this prosecutor general be sacked. This is where we say a rather big but, because basically that story is not backed up by what people remember from the time, what was reported at the time, or indeed any of the evidence which we've managed to uncover relating to that period. In short, this prosecutor general was seen by pretty much everybody, the international community, activists here, as being one who wasn't really interested in fighting corruption. And effectively, Joe Biden at the time said, we're going to attach a conditionality on a $1 billion loan guarantee. We're not going to keep on putting money into Ukraine if you continue having officials in place that we don't trust, that we think are simply spiriting the money away. So he at that point made it pretty clear that that was his conditionality. And that is, to be quite frank, what almost everyone who is credible around this story remember about why Viktor Shokin, this prosecutor general, was sacked.
So was this chap Shokin actually investigating this company, Burisma, which Hunter Biden was involved in?
Well, according to a sworn affidavit, which has surfaced in the last week or two, which Rudy Giuliani is waving around on American network TV, yes, Mr. Shokin says that he was indeed fired because he was investigating Burisma. Again, the evidence does not back that up. We know that there were several investigations which were technically open during Mr. Shokin's time in office. But in common with what we know about his period in office, he wasn't really actively pursuing any high-profile corruption cases. So there's no evidence really that those cases moved at all during his time in office. And indeed, even if there was some sort of investigation going on, they were not directly linked to Hunter Biden. They relate to a period before Hunter Biden even had a job at that company.
So as far as we know, has Hunter Biden done anything wrong?
No. As all the evidence suggests that Hunter Biden hasn't done anything wrong. I spoke to a former prosecutor general just this last weekend. He was pretty clear that under Ukrainian law, there was nothing to investigate relating to Hunter Biden or Joe Biden. There is a small but here, though. You do have to remember that Hunter Biden had very little relevant experience to put him in this particular job. So it certainly doesn't look good that he was getting, and a report suggests he might have been giving as much as $50,000 a month to be on the board of this controversial energy company, Burisma. There are valid questions to ask about how smart a decision it was for Biden Jr., if you like, to have this well-paid job, potentially just improving the reputation of this company at the same time as his father had such a key role in relation to Ukraine. What we've all been told from the sort of the Biden camp is that there was no discussion between them about Ukrainian issues, that they didn't see it as a conflict of interest. But clearly the optics of it are pretty bad. And I think they must now be regretting that they didn't take a stronger line at the time.
Now, I imagine that this has placed the Ukrainian president in quite a difficult position, because I imagine, too, that American support for Ukraine is pretty important for him.
The Ukrainian president, the Ukrainian government has been put in a horrendous position by all of this. The United States is Ukraine's most important ally. We have to remember that Ukraine is fighting a low-level war against Russian-backed rebels, Russian-backed forces in the east of Ukraine. And Ukraine needs not just the kind of the physical support that America provides in terms of kind of military infrastructure and hardware. It sort of needs the psychological support, because basically Ukraine is a relatively poor country standing up to the might of Russia effectively. They need to feel that America is behind them. So effectively, they've been put into a situation where they're being forced to make a choice between the current president of the United States and the man who, well, quite possibly could be the next president of the United States. Really, really difficult for the Ukrainians.
Jonah Fisher there, and earlier, Josh Gerstein. So that's how we got here. But where is it all going? I now want to know how exactly impeachment works in the United States. And how is the process affected by the context, the long run-up to the next presidential election? Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri is head of the US and Americas program at the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House. Leslie Vinjamuri, can you explain the process of impeachment in very general terms?
Generally, the process of impeachment began really when Nancy Pelosi decided that there would be impeachment hearings launched. And so now the House of Representatives in Congress will begin, but in fact carry on a series of investigations. And when it decides that it's ready, the House will take a vote. And that vote will be a simple majority vote as to whether or not to impeach President Trump. And at that point, the Senate will decide whether to take it up. And that trial has to be voted on. And that vote, of course, as we know, is a higher bar. Two-thirds of the Senate would have to vote to impeach the president. It wouldn't be out of keeping with the historical record to have this not go through the Senate. We tend to focus on the outcome when we talk about impeachment. I think it's the wrong way of looking at it. Impeachment is a process. It's a process when Nancy Pelosi, in this case, the Democratic Speaker of the House, stood up and said to Americans, there's something going on here. It is not right. And we need to put this to Congress. And in doing that, she also asked Americans to support the process. She asked the courts to support the process. She has the power of subpoena. And during that process, a lot will develop.
Now, what do you think we can say about the impact that the exposure of the Ukraine phone call affair has had so far in America?
I think that Americans are disturbed by this. The idea that the American president not only would put pressure on a foreign government to investigate the lead Democratic candidate at that time, Joe Biden. So something about working with the foreign government to undermine the integrity of the democratic process of the future elections. But also, it appears that there was a linkage, that there was a quid pro quo to the threat to withhold military assistance that had been appropriated, right? That was intended to be America's contribution to Ukraine's security. And I think Americans find that very troubling.
Now, in terms of a president of the United States asking the president of another country to do something which might conceivably help the president of the United States in terms of his own domestic situation, or even in terms of a genuine legal proposition. Have presidents done that before?
Well, if they've done it before and it's come into the public domain in this sort of way, it would have been called to account. It would have been investigated. It's tremendously serious. When you add to that the fact that this is about a former vice president, and that it's internal business. If you're a congressman, if you're an official representative, you don't talk about your political opponents or domestic politics while you're outside the country. And this, in effect, is a version of that. And I guess I would add to that that it's also in the context of the Mueller report, the clear evidence that Russia had tried to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. So Americans are very attuned to the presidential elections and the need to protect them.
Now, one of the things that's often said is that the process of inquiring into a president is this double-edged sword, which is that the public don't like it because, and it takes you away from, if you like, the domestic politics of the situation and situates it in terms of a group of people out to get this one guy. Do you think that relatively orthodox view holds in this instance?
I think that America's divided. And the danger, of course, is that proceeding with impeachment in this kind of highly polarized context risks that people see this as being very small politics. The important thing here is to make it very clear that this isn't about trying to take down a party or a president. It's about saying to an individual and sending the message to Americans that there are certain red lines in a democracy, that there is the rule of law, and to protect that, to scrutinize it, and to put it to hearings.
Do you think, finally, that this is a significant point in the Trump presidency, in this sense that we've often been told that other things are, and yet they haven't changed things dramatically?
Beyond a shadow of a doubt, this has officially been named an impeachment. These are hearings. These are not just the extension of ongoing investigations. Something categorically different is now taking place.
Leslie Vinjamuri. So that's the process, which leaves a lot of questions about how and whether that process might succeed and whether it deserves to. Joining me to discuss that are Elaine Kaymark, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and Amy Jeffress, a former federal prosecutor and a partner at the law firm Arnold & Porter, who's also in Washington. Elaine Kaymark, what are the historical parallels here?
Well, we've had only 3 prior impeachment inquiries. The very first one was Andrew Johnson after the Civil War. He narrowly escaped conviction in the Senate. Then we had the Nixon impeachment, which wasn't really quite an impeachment because the Republican senators went to him after the revelations of a taping system and they had Nixon on the tapes obstructing justice. The Republican senators went to him and said, look, you're going to lose in the House and you're going to lose in the Senate. So Richard Nixon decided to resign rather than impeach. And then we had the Bill Clinton impeachment, which did go to trial in the Senate, and it didn't come close to conviction. And that was, of course, over his affair with a White House intern, where he did lie under federal oath, which is a crime. But when it got to the Senate, frankly, most senators did not think that his actions, reprehensible as they may have been, they did not rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Which do you think it's most comparable to, Elaine?
Clearly, this is closest to the Nixon one. And the reason is that what the president looks like he has done is to use the power of the presidency and the resources of the United States government to dangle $391 million in military aid in front of the Ukrainian president in return for an investigation into his political rival. And I think it falls pretty squarely into the kinds of abuse of power that the framers were thinking of when they drafted the impeachment clause.
More so than over Russia, where the argument was that he had, at the very least, tried to obstruct justice in the case of the run-up to the Mueller inquiry.
I think we may end up with 2 articles of impeachment. One will be the abuse of power inherent in the Ukrainian case. And the second, I think, will be an obstruction of justice, ways that he tried to stop the investigation into Russia. The president has had several meetings with Putin, and there are no official readouts of any of those meetings. And the suspicion exists that notes on those meetings exist in a very highly classified computer system in the White House. And I suspect that in the coming months, there will be some members of Congress having a look at what's in that system.
Okay, so that's a wow moment. Amy, what kind of people are they going to call before their committees and what powers do they have to call?
They can call any witnesses they want to. And one issue is whether the witnesses who are currently in the administration will cooperate. And the House has various steps it can take to enforce subpoenas that it issues for witnesses. But the administration is already resisting, and that's going to be a battle.
Now, one possible pattern that sometimes happens is that when you have one whistleblower, that can lead to more. Elaine, do you expect any more damning evidence?
Well, we already know that the Inspector General at the State Department has issued an urgent memo to the Congress and obviously has some information about things that have been going on at the State Department. And the obvious pattern here that people want to know is, was this conversation with the Ukrainian president just sort of a one-off? Or has the president systematically engaged in a process whereby he has used his powers to get foreign leaders to get involved in his personal political fortunes.
Amy, on what basis is Donald Trump going to argue against this?
We can expect the same lines of attack that he used to criticize the Mueller inquiry, and those are that this process is being initiated by the left-wing Democrats, that it's a witch hunt, that it's his enemies. There are some new angles, however. He is directly attacking the whistleblower of being a partisan, and we still don't know who the whistleblower is. I don't believe that the president knows who it is, so there's no basis for that, but that's the line of attack.
I suppose I'm wondering at what level the mere facts themselves, as they come out, are bigger than any attempt to argue around them.
That's an excellent point. So some of the critics of the whistleblower are attacking the whistleblower and saying that his report or her report is based on hearsay. The motives of the whistleblower are a bit beside the point when you have the actual notes from the phone call that show that the president was asking the president of Ukraine to investigate his chief rival for the 2020 election.
Hey, Elaine, can we just explore the circumstances under which Republican senators and Republican supporters in the media might change their views about whether or not they're going to support Donald Trump?
I think that if it turns out that there were other countries that Donald Trump was trying to engage in his campaign for re-election, I think that there will be Republican senators and there will be Republican voters who begin to think maybe we are better off with Mike Pence as president. We're not there yet. But one of the ways that this could develop is that Republican senators, looking at their possible loss of control of the Senate in 2020, decide that actually it's better to make a clean break with Trump, start again at the beginning of the year with Mike Pence as the president, run Mike Pence as the president, and see if they can't limit their losses. Now, it's interesting that Donald Trump so far is, he's got himself a political defense. His political defense is to call everybody spies and treasonous, and he's really out there with the rhetoric. What he does not yet have is he does not yet have a legal defense, and people are waiting to see what that will be.
Now, with both of you, what's your best guess, starting with you, Amy, as to what actually will happen?
Well, it looks to me as if the House of Representatives will end up issuing articles of impeachment. But I want to make a point about the process and the way that the Constitution has set this up. The House of Representatives is the body of our government that is closest to the people. So every member of the House has to run for re-election every 2 years. This House was just elected in 2018. So these members are constantly looking at the politics in their districts, making sure that they have the support of their voters. So the mood of the American people and whether the American people think that this phone call and the associated behavior crossed the line is going to be a very important factor. And that will be true in the Senate as well, although in the Senate, they only run for re-election every 6 years, so they may take a more measured long-run view. But in the House, it's very much a political question.
Elaine, I know you're going to agree with that, so I'm going to extend the question even further to ask you what you think the American people will think.
Well, I'll start with a little piece of history. On the day he resigned, Richard Nixon had a 24% approval rating among the American public. So 24% was his floor. And my guess is that Donald Trump has a floor of somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30%. What everyone is going to look at is what is the pattern amongst his supporters. And when he starts getting down to that rock bottom, that means that there will be certain United States senators who think that it is politically useful to separate from Trump. So we're going to watch what the American people do. They have already moved a little bit just in the last week in favor of impeachment and conviction. So we'll see if that continues as the case gets made. And obviously, there's a lot of pressure on the House members to make a case that is convincing not just to the 100 United States senators, but to the American people.
Elaine came up there with Amy Jeffress. I suppose the orthodox view has always been that it would be a bad idea for the Democrats to pursue impeachment, just as it was a bad idea for the Republicans to do it to Bill Clinton a few years back. It's just that this time, the polls are suggesting that actually President Trump's doing rather badly on this issue with the American public, so is it possible that orthodoxy could be wrong? Anyway, my thanks to Josh Gerstein, Jonah Fisher, Leslie Vinjamuri, Elaine Kmark and Amy Jeffress. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Leslie McAlpine, Serena Tarling and Siobhan O'Connell. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.